What next? A new report says it's time to think big about a post-pandemic Lone Star State. A just-released roadmap for a more inclusive Texas. That's today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown, former State Senator Kirk Watson of the University of Houston and Stephen Pedigo of UT unveil a joint 9-point proposal for a stronger Texas after COVID-19. We'll talk to him. Also, dangers in the fields of the valley where essential workers labor unprotected. And can you run a railroad with no tracks? An implausible sounding question with major implications for the Texas bullet train. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this Wednesday, May 13th, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. For all that is yet unclear about the true impact of this pandemic on Texas, we know many have been hurt and more are set to be. As the number of deaths attributed to the coronavirus continues to grow, so do the number of Texans unemployed and the number of families struggling. What do we do now? It's a question with a rather short time horizon when matters of how soon to reopen or return to business are questions of survival. But there's a reason to think we should also be careful not to squander this moment as well. Only once in a generation, if that, is the established order so profoundly shaken up as to make it possible to imagine and reinvent ourselves into a better us. And that is exactly what a first-of-its-kind report released today is asking us to do, to picture ourselves post-pandemic as a more inclusive, more resilient Texas. In a partnership between UT's LBJ School and U of H's new Hobby School of Public Affairs, the authors of this new report propose a 9-point roadmap, 9 actions we should consider taking now to invest in the skills and strengths of Texas. Joining us to talk about their plan, former state senator and founding dean of the Hobby School, Kirk Watson. Dean Watson, welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
And we also have Stephen Pedigo joining us. He's professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, University of Texas at Austin, and the inaugural director of the LBJ Urban Lab. Professor Pedigo, welcome.
It's great to be with you.
Let's talk about this joint project between Hobby and the LBJ School, a playbook for resiliency. What was the inspiration here? I guess you saw an opportunity.
Well, that's right. And I'll kick it off by saying that, you know, we're going through a monumental event, but it's more than an event. The COVID-19 pandemic, which has changed virtually every aspect of American life, is going to create a new condition that we'll be living in. And as we say in our report, we're in essence, the world has been put in a timeout. And what I mean by that, I'm using a sports analogy there, even though I'm sad I'm not watching any live current sports. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is that it's like we've called a timeout in all aspects of our life, including the economic aspects of our life. And during that timeout, we've been able to see this pandemic has shown a pretty harsh light on some of the failings of our system and some of the inequities. And so what Professor Pedigo and I are saying is that as we come out of this timeout and we start back in the game, we shouldn't just try to recreate the past, but we ought to learn from this, and we need a new playbook so that we will make the Texas economy more resilient, more equitable, and a better foundation for our future.
Well, now I'm looking at the executive summary of the document that was released today, and you have basically 9 bullet points here. And I want to maybe hit on a couple of these. And Professor Pedigo, I want to hit you with this first one. Build partnerships instead of rivalries. Already, we're hearing this discussion about the pandemic being framed in starkly political terms that predate the pandemic, right? So how do you start to build partnerships and avoid those rivalries?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, one of the things I would encourage us all to do is look to what many of our local communities are doing. You know, if you look here just in Austin, for instance, or even in Houston, one of the things that's been really heartening is to see economic development organizations, chamber organizations, county and local governments come together to think about how they reopen their communities. And so, you know, typically when we think about economic development across the state of Texas, a lot of times it's been very much sort of a winner take all, right? You win, I kind of lose sometimes. But what's been exciting about this is that many local jurisdictions and communities are planning and thinking together. And I think one of the things that Kirk and I sort of suggest in the report is that is fundamentally important for us to continue to go forward, because as we push this thing out and start to think about how we reopen and more importantly rebuild, it is going to require us to collaborate because resources will be tight. We're going to need the best thinking. We're going to need to be able to build and look to best practices with each other. So collaboration is going to be essential.
Let's talk a little bit about the increase in investments here that you're calling for. You call for an increase in healthcare investments for economic development and investing in the skills of Texans. Now, some of our listeners may know this, some may not, but Dean Watson has quite a bit of experience among lawmakers. He's served in the state Senate, and so he knows what it's like to have to wrestle down a budget. How are you going to make investment increases at a time when we're dealing with pretty big hits to stuff like the Rainy Day Fund, Dean Watson?
Well, that is a perfect example, if you will, of taking advantage of the time out and saying, how can we do things better and different? Instead of saying that what we're going to do is we're just going to approach our budgeting and our finances in the way we used to, when we felt like we had, a luxury, I call it a perceived luxury of affluence. So we didn't really have to think about how do you make an investment in a detailed way? Are there other revenue streams we ought to be looking at? What kind of return do we get on certain investments? Part of what we're suggesting is that now's the time to say, let's reevaluate how you go about doing those things. For example, what we talk about as an action item is making investment in healthcare in such a way that you're not only gaining federal dollars you wouldn't otherwise be gaining, because, again, we acted as though we had the luxury of affluence and we just politically didn't need to do certain things, but draw down those additional dollars where you get a bigger return. For every dollar you invest, you get a return of $1.62. And by doing that, what you're doing is you're putting more money into the system and you're investing in existing businesses. Those businesses are hospitals, health clinics. You're investing in jobs, doctors, and healthcare professionals. And you're also investing in your workforce in a way where they stay healthier so that they're able to continue to work. But it all comes back to this idea that if we want to be more resilient, now is the time for us to think differently and not just try to recreate the past or act like the formula we have to face during a legislative session is the one that we always used.
Is there a way of doing this? I mean, because this ultimately requires, as we've been mentioning, a lot of investment. I mean, that's a touchstone throughout this document. And it seems to me that this would require more than just grants and federal monies. Is there another revenue stream that should be considered for Texas, especially at this juncture? I'll just throw it out there, jump ball.
Yeah, I think if you look at the report, one of the things that we call on is for the business community also to play a really important role here. You know, the state of Texas has done a really significant job in the way that it has attracted businesses to the state of Texas in terms of, incentive dollars, encouraging a really good business climate. You know, one of the things I think that we can say now is as we look cross-sectoral, look for other players to play a role, maybe the business community steps up here and thinks about how it improves some of its on-ramping programs and skill-based programs. We talked about talent and skilling in the report, and it's a critical piece. And that really is the driver of development today. So can businesses invest back in people? And can we incentivize them to do that as we think about attracting more companies to the state? The other thing I would say is that in this report, we make a pretty strong argument that our university systems can step up a bit as well. Yes. You know, universities have in Texas, we have some of the best research institutions in the entire country. Mm-hmm. But there is an opportunity for those institutions to step up and play roles in economic development and thinking about how maybe they use their purchasing power, their employment power, their abilities as conveners to play a role in resources for communities. So I think, as Senator Watson said, or excuse me, Dean Watson has said, is that you know, there is a great opportunity in this report that we're suggesting that let's make the tent larger. Let's look for all of us to play a role in trying to move Texas forward.
And the one thing I would add to that is, since you ask about revenue, is go back to the idea that in the past we have, because of affluence and the belief that things were going to happen a certain way, we sometimes limited what we were willing to look at in terms of revenue. One of the things that we mentioned in this document is that maybe now we can also look to how we release some of the pent-up demand of private capital that wants to invest in things like infrastructure, something that we have certainly in the recent past avoided. But it might be available and it might be needed now, because that would free up funds and revenue that would otherwise be used for that infrastructure on other things.
There's a whole lot of digging that one can do there's a lot of interesting points in this Playbook for Resiliency, a first of its kind document, which is coming from the Hobby School of Public Affairs, University of Houston, and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. This is a co-production. We've been speaking with the founding dean of the Hobby School, Kirk Watson, former Texas state senator, and we've also been talking with Stephen Pedigo. He's professor at the LBJ School. Thank you both for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
Glad you're covering it. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right, social media editor Wells Dunbar joins us once again with the Talk of Texas. Hello there, Wells.
Hey, David. Well, following from what we just heard, we're hearing from folks about the reopening of Texas from the bigger picture to the smaller facts on the ground. I'll be back with some of those reactions later in the show. You know, David, you talked about the political polarization going on amid the pandemic a little bit. One example of that, which has folks buzzing, the Office of Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton firing off letters to local municipalities claiming that they cannot issue stricter public health guidelines than the governor. We've shared more about it via Facebook. Here's some of what we're hearing from folks. Kay Garth says that for a state governance that wants to minimize the federal government's dictates, it's ironic that the Texas Republican governance is happy to dictate to local cities. Just one of many stories we're watching out there this Wednesday, David. I'll be back with more stories from social later in the program. What
you
are you seeing out
will.
There?
I was just thinking, we have an interesting conversation coming up here, Wells. I think you're going to be really interested in hearing it. Essential workers in the Valley, migrant workers laboring unprotected from coronavirus. Hear all about it in a couple of minutes. We're looking forward to hearing from you, Texas. You know what to do. Just reach out to us at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar back in 35 with more of your comments.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Dozens of counties violated the election code in 2018 and may do so again this November, effectively disenfranchising many Texas voters. So claims the Texas Civil Rights Project in a letter sent to the Texas Secretary of State this week. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports.
For the better part of a year, Zach Dahling has been analyzing the state's 254 counties for a series of election code violations.
I'm just cleaning up my notes from a deposition earlier today. We've been in depositions all week, and I've been taking most of the notes.
The lawyer with the Texas Civil Rights Project discovered that nearly three dozen counties, from urban to rural, with cities big and small, broke election laws. That's because the number of polling places in 2018 was as much as 270 below what Texas required, explained Dahling in a Zoom call.
These 33 counties collectively have about 4 million registered voters in them. So in one sense, it affected all of those voters, because for every missing polling place, that means longer lines, more people at the remaining polling places.
Dawling sent demand letters to counties about the violations that ranged from not having a voting center in an area heavy with people of color to improperly combining precincts and reducing the number of polling places and voting centers below the legal limit. Some counties didn't respond, but most did and committed to making changes.
And then there were a couple of counties that, even after back and forths, basically said, it's just too hard for us to fix these issues right now, and we're just going to wait until after the census and the redistricting that follows that.
Pam Ohlendorf is the elections administrator in Caldwell County. They only had 12 of the 16 polling places required, she says, because they didn't have enough poll workers. This November, she's hoping for 17.
So I'm hoping to have the manpower. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. Yeah, I can only do so much. You know, I still have to stay in compliance by having the proper amount of people to work it.
Dawling with the Texas Civil Rights Project says the Secretary of State is supposed to be vigilant about these issues, especially given Texas's history of gerrymandering and voter suppression.
It is the duty of the Office of the Secretary of State under the law to be monitoring Texas counties for compliance with the law. And it's pretty clear from what we found that the Secretary of State has not been doing that.
In their letter to Secretary Ruth Hughes, the Texas Civil Rights Project asked the state to ensure all counties have enough polling places and take legal action if necessary. The Secretary of State did not respond to TPR's request for comment.
It's extremely important that every single person has a fair shot at voting.
Geronimo Cortina is a University of Houston professor. His research shows the farther you move a polling place, the less likely people are to go vote, especially among low-income voters, which in Texas is more likely to be Latino.
The state cannot impose policies that are going to have a differential effect depending on your socioeconomic status, your race and ethnicity. That you cannot do when you're talking about elections, because that's the bedrock of our democracy.
Dawling's analysis is purely about the numbers, not about intent, and largely not about impacts on protected groups. But in addition to calling out the state on its lack of oversight, he hopes it inspires local groups to do their own digging and ensure they aren't being discriminated against. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Deep in the Rio Grande Valley, there's a fertile zone near the border where the onion harvest is in full swing at the moment, even as the rest of the state fights COVID-19 with restrictions and lockdowns elsewhere. Each year, an estimated 300,000 migratory and seasonal agricultural workers pass through the area around Far San Juan and Alamo, Texas, according to the National Center for Farm Worker Health. But advocates for those workers say most don't have access to personal protective equipment during the COVID-19 pandemic. Juanita Valdez-Cox is executive director of LUPE, La Union del Pueblo Entero, which is a community union and advocacy organization. I understand, Ms. Valdez-Cox, you just returned from distributing some masks to many workers. Is that right?
That is correct. That was a young man by the name of Salvador who came down from Houston. He's 16 years old, and he made 500 masks, and he wanted us to take him to the fields to go ahead and distribute, and that is what we did. And we had signs thanking the farm workers for their very, very important work. And the majority did not have masks. So as soon as we passed out the masks, they put them on to wear them.
Let me ask you something. Farm workers, obviously considered essential personnel, they haven't stopped working. Why no protection? Is there none to be had?
You know what? I think they're just forgotten. This country forever has just not want to acknowledge the important work that the farm workers do. They harvest all of our fruits and vegetables, and yet, as essential as they are, this government refuses to acknowledge how important they are. I also believe a total lack of respect for those that risk their lives so that we can have the food that we need. And so there's something really wrong in this country when all of these workers are willing to come to work because they're in such poverty, but don't take advantage of the fact that they need to work and provide them with the protective gear that they need.
Something I want to understand, though, don't employers have an obligation to provide their workers with personal protective equipment?
Of course, they do, and they should. But the employers want their harvest, you know, their onion harvest and their melon, their watermelon to be harvested, but they don't give them protective gear.
Now that's an important thing, because there's been a fight, as you well know, over adequate facilities for farm workers that's been going on for decades. My question, though, is aren't there minimum state standards and are laws being violated because this personal protective equipment isn't being provided? I mean, surely there must be toilets and hand washing stations and cups for drinking water and that sort of thing, right?
Yes, and there is a policy on that, and it should be provided. But sometimes, like this field, we travel miles and miles into a very rural area, and there's few inspectors for this county to go out and make sure that that is being provided. So when there's nobody watching, of course they don't abide, and that's almost criminal to do that to farm workers, who everybody considers essential workers.
I would imagine because of your tax status, you're forbidden from lobbying. Am I correct?
That is correct. Alupe is a 501c3.
How can you make government officials aware of the conditions there if you're not able to speak on behalf of those workers?
Oh, but we do, because even as a 501c3, we have a very, very strong get out the vote. The elected officials, they know who we are. But this issue comes all the way from the top. We have a government that discriminates so much against immigrants, a government that is so racist against undocumented immigrants, and that filters down. And if the head is showing total disrespect, just what the others do. And we do continue to pressure local officials. And that's why we have some of those policies. When I was in the field, there was nothing like that. No toilets, no hand washing facilities, no cups for the drinking water. All of that changed in the 80s because we did a lot of work. But why should that be the way for us to be able to get what farm workers need? It shouldn't be that difficult.
Juanita Valdez-Cox is with Lupe, La Union del Pueblo Entero. She's been speaking with us about the conditions faced by thousands of farm workers in Texas during COVID-19.
Yes.
Thank you so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The state prison system is ramping up coronavirus testing as the number of cases among inmates and staff continue to climb. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice is deploying tens of thousands of self-administered COVID-19 oral fluid tests, which were approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration last month. Agency spokesperson Jeremy Diesel says 12 strike teams are responsible for distributing the tests to inmates and staff.
And then picking those test packets back up again, getting them coded into the systems, and getting them off to get results.
Diesel said on Tuesday alone, 1,500 tests were administered and collected in the span of 3 hours. Just over 650 TDCJ workers and more than 1,700 inmates have tested positive for the virus since the pandemic began. At least 30 prisoners have died. The families of about 3.6 million Texas school children will soon be eligible for extra money to pay for groceries. As KERA's Christopher Connolly reports, state officials are rolling out a new plan to help support families with kids who qualify for free and reduced-priced lunches.
The extra money will come as a one-time $285 payment through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, better known as food stamps. The idea is to help lower-income families cover the cost of extra meals that kids are eating at home these days because schools are closed. Parents and guardians of kids who qualify for free and reduced-price meals can get the extra grocery money by signing up for the new pandemic EBT program. The application period starts June 1st. Some families who already use SNAP benefits will automatically have the extra money loaded onto their Lone Star cards. Others will still have to apply to receive the benefit. School districts are expected to send out information soon. I'm Christopher Connolly in Fort Worth.
Also starting today, all SNAP recipients in Texas can buy groceries online at Walmart and Amazon. The University of Houston College of Medicine is offering a new certificate program to meet the growing demand for COVID-19 contact tracers. UH Professor LaChauncey Woodard says hundreds of students have registered for the free online course.
This course has been collaboratively developed with both our city and county health department. So our goal is that this will prepare students who will be trained and certified, and they're ready to act if called upon and fill the need for our health departments.
Contact tracers help COVID-19 patients identify people they have interacted with and then alert those individuals about their potential exposure. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from BiteAway, a chemical-free treatment alternative to instantly relieve the itch and pain caused by insect bites. Portable, reusable, and no mess. Suitable for children. Learn more at TakeTheBiteAway.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Can a company be a railroad company if it doesn't have any trains? This isn't a riddle or a Socratic icebreaker. It's a real legal question, one that has dogged the proposed bullet train between Houston and Dallas for years. It's important here because the legal designation of railroad means the company behind the project, Texas Central Railway, can use eminent domain to secure the land it needs for the line. The company didn't have that until late last week when Texas's 13th Court of Appeals decided that, yes, Texas Central Railway was in fact a railroad, despite not having any trains yet. The decision was a disappointment to landowners and property rights advocates who opposed the project. Joining us now to tell us more, Evan Hupfer. He is transportation reporter for the Dallas Business Journal. Evan, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
So how did this appeals court determine that Texas Central Railway can use eminent domain as a railroad company? Can you just call yourself a railroad company and you are one?
You know, that's the key question. And it doesn't appear that this debate is over. You know, I talked with the opposition for the project. And yes, the Court of Appeals ruled against the landowners in the case, but they intend to take this all the way to the Texas Supreme Court. So I don't think we've heard the last of this question of whether or not you could be a railroad and not have any trains or tracks or anything. Getting the eminent domain designation is absolutely key because the company developing this project, Texas Central, has only about a third of the land that they need to build this project. Uh-huh. It's evident that some ranchers will never sell to this company of their own volition, so they need that eminent domain.
Eminent domain, yes. Before we go much further, we probably need to explain to folks who aren't quite up to speed, if you will, on this bullet train. They don't call it a bullet train. What do they call this thing, and where is it supposed to run?
Yeah, so Texas High Speed Rail Project, that's kind of what I've been calling it. It's a project that's been in the works since back in 2012. It's going to be a train between Dallas and Houston. It's going to run 200 miles an hour. It's going to get you there in 90 minutes. They have one stop planned in the kind of the Texas A&M region. And if it comes actually to reality, this will be one of the most significant transportation projects in the history of Texas.
Okay, so let's talk about the more immediate future and perhaps the clear and present danger for some landowners in the proposed path of this train who've held out, I guess what, they're going to get eminent domain notices in the not too distant future now with this decision?
Well, that is the question that I'm actually trying to figure out is, you know, can the company start using its eminent domain even if the court case is under appeal, under consideration for appeal through the Texas Supreme Court? So it's a very hazy process. They still have a lot to decipher.
I see. So how much land does the Texas Central Railway think it may have to condemn in order to secure this line?
You know, that's another good question. So this project is going to cost $20 billion about. And they, like I said, they have options to purchase about a third of the land. And if a landowner thus far hasn't been willing to sell their land to Texas Central, then I'd be hard-pressed to, you know, in 2 or 3 years if they would change their mind, unless, you know, there's a change of ownership with the land. But they're going to have to use eminent domain, I think, for a significant portion, you know, probably, I would guess, between 25 and 50% of the land.
Well, what are the landowners who oppose this project saying? Just, I don't want a train coming through my backyard, is that the idea?
Pretty much. And, you know, the key difference between this and other eminent domain projects, like, you know, pipelines and highways and stuff like that, is those projects benefit the landowners who have to have their land condemned through eminent domain. They say, you know, if I live in Ellis County, there's no benefit to me because there's no stop in Ellis County. I would have to drive all the way to Dallas and then be on the train for 90 minutes. So it just take less time to go to Houston via my car. So that's kind of the main opposition is with previous eminent domain projects, there's been benefit to the rural landowners. There is none with this project.
We should ask quickly, any sense of whether or not this project has in any way been jeopardized by the ongoing coronavirus issue?
Yeah. So at the end of March, Texas Central laid off a good portion of their staff. I believe it was 28 employees. And that was a direct result of the financial uncertainty through the coronavirus. You know, like I said, this is going to cost $20 billion. That's going to be pretty hard to find, especially now in this recessionary environment that we're facing. So yes, it definitely is affecting it. You know, whether or not Texas Central can kind of hold on to get to the end of this recessionary environment, and then investors have the appetite for a big infrastructure project like this, that's going to be the key question.
It's a developing story. Evan Hupfer is a transportation reporter for the Dallas Business Journal who's covering it. Evan, thanks so much for breaking it down for us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you for your time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, helping patients fight cancer with telemedicine. Virtual online appointments are available for patients to continue their cancer journey while practicing safe social distancing. More at texasoncology.com.
I'm Shoba Dasari. I'm 19 years old, and I'm the co-founder of Spell Pundit.
My name is Sharaf Dasari. I'm 17 years old. I'm the co-founder of Spell Pundit, and we basically provide online preparation for kids interested in participating in spelling bees. And recently, we've decided to host an online spelling bee.
My brother and I both got involved in spelling bees around 2011.
I think the main motivation was probably my sister won like her school spelling bee, and then she won the district spelling bee too. So she went all the way to like the Houston regional spelling bee. And then after that, it was just kind of like, I guess, a competitiveness. Like I was just like, why don't I start doing this too? So
the first year that I went to the National Spelling Bee was 2013. It was honestly a really amazing experience. I met so many spellers that year, and I made it to the semifinals that year as well. So just like that experience of being on stage and like having all these lights and cameras and everything like in your face while you're trying to spell, it's definitely nerve-wracking, but it's also super exhilarating. Just the fact that I can tell people that, hey, I've been on ESTN, even though I'm like one of the most unathletic people out there. it's pretty great.
We've actually been discussing like having an online spelling bee for like a while now, but I guess it was just the cancellation of the National Spelling Bee that kind of made us want to do it even more. I mean, we've been expecting that it would get postponed at least, and it was looking a lot likelier that it would get canceled. But one of the more surprising things was when they basically came out and said in their announcement, like, people who were eighth graders this year, like, so they're in their last year of eligibility, they wouldn't be able to like go back to the National Spelling Bee next year, even if they qualified for it this year.
And yeah, like neither of us could imagine what it would be like if during our eighth grade year, our last year of eligibility, we were just told that, no, the bee's canceled, we're not doing this anymore. Like, I can imagine how like heartbreaking that would be for a speller, especially for like some of those spellers that you see up in the final rounds of the National Spelling Bee. They've spent probably like the last 4 or 5 years of their life just like studying for this bee. Spelling Bee community is pretty competitive, but they're also very collaborative and very friendly. Once you get to the national levels, there's a very like close-knit community of spellers who've been to the National Spelling Bee. So you start to get to know these people really well and become really good friends with them. And I am still still in touch with some of the people that I met through Spelling Bees. Actually, a lot of them I have personally reached out to and asked them to be judges for our Spelling Bee. So that's been really cool.
My name is Sharav Dasari. I'm 17 years old. I'm the co-founder of Spell Pundit.
I'm Shobha Dasari. I'm 19 years old, and I'm the co-founder of Spell Pundit. And you're listening to the Texas Standard.
You're on Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. They're often called the live arts. Theaters, choral groups, dance troupes, orchestras, and they're all facing the same stark question. Will they still be alive by the end of the summer? From North Texas, KERA's Jerome Weeks surveys the situation there.
Only 2 months into our COVID isolation, and the toll on local arts performances has been grim. Sold-out Broadway tours of Hamilton and Frozen have been postponed or shut down. The Clyburn canceled its amateur piano competition. Half the staff of Dallas Office of Arts and Culture was furloughed. The AT&T Performing Arts Center canceled or rescheduled 40 dance, music, and theater shows. Fort Worth Opera shut down its season. All of it. Shakespeare Dallas canceled its summer season, the first time in 49 years.
It was a painful decision.
Raphael Perry is Shakespeare Dallas Artistic Director.
Even today, I'm starting to get the notifications from the Workforce Commission that this person's applied for unemployment. And, you know, each day it's another reminder that this artist or a technician doesn't have work right now.
Dion Kennedy is president of Performing Arts Fort Worth, which runs Bass Hall. She says it's not just the catastrophic loss of ticket revenue. What's pushing the arts to the wall is the inability to find solutions.
This virus has been so unpredictable. So we are literally just taking things day by day.
Concert promoters and Broadway producers are the ones who typically decide whether your favorite show comes to town. It's not venues like Bass Hall or the Iceman Center. And Governor Abbott's Reopening Texas for Business hasn't changed that.
When it's a touring production, they can't do one date and then be off the following month. So it is an effort that has to be coordinated nationwide for us to bring tours back.
Presenters like the Dallas Summer Musicals and Performing Arts Fort Worth often take their cue from Broadway. And right now, September is the most optimistic prediction for Broadway reopening. North Texans may not be seeing Broadway tours this summer. Local professional theater companies also face hurdles beyond their control. The primary concern of Equity, the Actors Union, is its members' safety. It now requires theaters to have a plan for protecting the actors' health before they'll sign a contract. Raphael Perry considered working one up until he thought of Shakespeare Dallas' summertime setting.
We work outdoors, and I can't disinfect a five-acre park.
Theater directors share Equity's concerns about infection, but they're also flummoxed. How many stage dramas exist with no close physical interactions at all? Kevin Moriarty is the Dallas Theater Center's artistic director.
Quite simply, we cannot hire professional actors to act on a stage and perform close to each other in a safe manner. That's devastating for our art form and for our business model.
Musicians and dancers face these same concerns about working safely. And even if arts groups can resolve these onstage issues, there are all the difficulties with maintaining the audience's social distance in lobbies, restrooms, theater seats. Because of COVID, arts groups have turned to live streaming performances. But it's clear these won't generate enough revenue. So, in this sea of uncertainty, nonprofit groups struggle to stay afloat while leaking money and not knowing where they're headed. Moriarty says he and other theater directors have mapped out 3 possible futures. The first has COVID fading by summer's end.
And we're able to perform plays for full audiences safely in the fall.
The second sees fall performances, but with audiences limited to 25%. Moriarty calls this a challenge. The third scenario has COVID deaths raging again by fall, as medical experts have warned. If so, Moriarty says, there will be no new season this fall or next spring.
The question all of us have is, do we need to wait for a vaccine to re-engage with our art form? And we don't know, which means it could be the fall of 2021 before we see live performance return in any meaningful way.
Audiences will not show up until they feel safe at public events. And that may mean the live arts will have to stay alive while their stages are dark for more than a year. I'm Jerome Weeks in Dallas.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. President Donald Trump says that new technology is helping healthcare workers recycle masks. He says, quoting here, "We're also using a sterilization process, some great equipment that will sterilize masks up to 20 times per mask. So that's like ordering 20 times more masks." Is that a fact? Joining us to look into it is Madeline Meckelberg of PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you, too.
I think your math is much better than mine, but I'm just trying to sort through this claim here. According to the president, some great equipment, and it's great equipment, that will sterilize masks up to 20 times per mask is like ordering 20 times more masks. What was the context for this claim?
So, first of all, thank you for complimenting my math abilities. I will listen to that over and over again. But Trump said this at a recent press conference. He was responding to complaints that have surfaced from frontline healthcare workers who've said they don't have enough access to personal protective equipment or PPE. And a lot of that blame they've put on the shoulders of the Trump administration. And so Trump was responding and saying, you know, those claims are overblown. Hospitals have the tools they need. And he made this claim, quote, "We're also using a sterilization process, some great equipment that will sterilize masks up to 20 times per mask. So that's like ordering 20 times more masks. And it's working very well."
Well, there are two questions, right? Whether masks can be sterilized. I don't know. Can they? And what about whether that's the same as ordering 20 times more masks?
So the technology that Trump is describing here does exist. It seems to be a description of the Battelle Memorial Institute, which has this critical care decontamination system that they use to sanitize N95 masks for reuse.
Oh. Wow.
And the way it works is that hospitals send their masks to this company, which cleans them using a vapor phase hydrogen peroxide product. It takes about 12 hours to do the whole process. And the company has said that the masks actually can withstand the process up to 20 times without losing their filtering ability.
Oh, the old vapor phase technique. All right.
Exactly.
So, yes. So 20 times more masks. What about that claim?
So that's where the president's statement kind of goes off the rails. The first issue here is that just because these masks can be sanitized 20 times doesn't mean that they actually should be. So first of all, there's been very limited research about this process and the effectiveness, and the mask's ability to stand up to the procedure can vary depending on the mask. So they're talking about how it can be cleaned 20 times and retain its filtering ability, but that's only part of a mask's effectiveness. The integrity of the mask itself is also really important. And one thing that's not factored in here is just kind of the general wear and tear that a mask may go through during the course of a normal day at a hospital. So even if a mask is reused, it could lose its shape, and that totally affects its effectiveness, if you will. And there's another factor here, and that's that this process requires hospitals to have protocol in place for actually safely collecting these masks and transporting them to this facility. This is not something that's available everywhere. So given that they could have been used by workers exposed to the coronavirus, that's especially important here. So the bottom line is that experts have said this process is great, but it by no means is a substitute for brand new masks.
Okay. So the process, you can sterilize it, it sounds like, But the real question mark is whether or not it's the equivalent of ordering 20 times more masks. And it sounds like there are serious concerns about a breakdown in the masks if you do something like this. So is there enough here to make a ruling?
Definitely. As you said, Trump is right that technology exists to sterilize these masks, but there's a lot of unknown here. So we rated this claim half true.
Half true. President Trump's claim about sterilizing masks for healthcare workers. That fact check comes from the fact checkers at PolitiFact. Madeline Meckelberg heads up PolitiFact Texas. Madeline, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
You know, Wells Dunbar, I think she actually likes doing that, and you were listening to the Texas Standard. I think she actually really enjoys that that process.
I've gotten used to it. I enjoy hearing it myself, you know? I like it.
What are Texans talking about on this Wednesday, Wells?
Well, we're hearing from folks about some of those topics we were talking about at the beginning of the show, the reopening of Texas and sort of the big picture there. Many people excited about some of the prescriptions there, but also there's some, I guess you could say, anger and sort of tentative reactions about these bigger picture things when we can't really get through the smaller issues that's people are bringing up here. Here's what I'm talking about. One example from Brad Emmons, longtime listener. He says this, that people are having this difficulty even coming to an agreement on whether or not to wear a mask in public. Here's what Brad says about that. He says, if the defiant are so damn tough, then how come wearing a mask for 10 minutes to go to the store, pick up a pizza, or get into my Lyft is such a Herculean chore? I mean, you're getting a reopening. Why be so pouty about this one easy part? And similarly, another listener, Leah Keese, she's not exactly optimistic about the chances for a full recovery like we saw prior to the pandemic. She says this isn't going to be a full recovery. What there will be is a mitigation and a decline of cases. The problem right now we have is that we're not in that situation right now. We're in the exact place we were 2 months ago, save for the fact that we have more COVID cases. She goes on to say, do I think we need to be shut down completely? No. But however, we can't even get people to wear masks in public, so it won't matter what other efforts we make since we can't perform the basics. So honestly, not a lot of optimism out there among our Texas Standard listeners.
Sounds like it.
You know, one thing I would add is that I guess one performance sort of meant to buoy people's spirits happening in Central Texas today. I'm referring to this Blue Angels air show taking place over Central Texas. Design planned to hit San Antonio this afternoon, followed by Austin. I believe those start times were pushed up about an hour or so due to weather. San Antonio expected to see the Angels air show around 2:20 p.m. Central. Austin looking at about 3:40. Lots of people sort of excited about it, but other folks kind of questioning, I guess you could say, the expense of such a program. Janelle Vollmer asks if they'll be dropping PPE supplies. Meanwhile, Keith Adam Paxton asks, he says he wonders what the pilots are thinking. I mean, they're just following orders, correct? I doubt they can speak to the press, but how do they feel about being paraded above an ongoing crisis below? That in reference to that Blue Angels air show today.
Well, you know, this is supposed to be a salute to first responders.
Right.
So I would rather think they would feel pretty proud about it, but it's just a guess, I suppose. And probably should talk to the pilots. But yeah, that's the purpose of this. The purpose of this event is to call attention and salute those who have been on the front lines, the essential workers and such.
Yeah, about that. No question about the support for those folks. But I guess what we're hearing from some of our friends and listeners is whether or not this is indeed the best way to actually salute those people instead of using some of that money to help them with the essentials they might need. Of the controversies that's been brought up by this whole situation we've been thrust into. We're continuing to monitor it. Lots of conversations unfolding on our Facebook page there at facebook.com/Texas Standard.
And there we have it. Out of time for the big broadcast, but of course we're going to be back here tomorrow. You can keep up with the news over at texasstandard.org anytime 24/7. Till tomorrow, I'm Dave Brown along with Wells Dunbar. Wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.